Thank you for tuning in to the Essential Church Podcast, a church where we focus on restoration over denomination. If you're in the Virginia Beach area and would like to find out more about Essential Church, visit our webpage at essentialchurch.com.
One of the all-time great iconic scenes from any movie. I think any movie scene that can get a statue permanently placed in a major city in the country is probably a pretty good scene. Some of you are probably watching it asking yourself, where are all the kids? I thought there was a bunch of kids who ran after him, right? That's Rocky 2, 3, 4, 5, and on. There's always kids in the later ones. And the original one is just him. It's him by himself going through this grueling process of training. And the thing about the fight game is this. It starts off with you get signed to a fight. In other words, a matchmaker, somebody puts together this fight, they do the contract, and when that happens, it makes news. And there's press conferences, and people interview you and talk about it, and there's a lot of buildup and hype for this fight that's going to come. But the fight doesn't actually happen for anywhere from 6 months to a year from that time. And in the month leading up to the fight, it really ramps up, and the promoters are out there, and you're on talk shows, and you're on the sports channels, and they're trying to do pay-per-view buys, and it's just really exciting time, and it's just really flashy and exciting. The thing about it is, though, there's a very long middle that nobody ever really talks about in the boxing world, because the middle is not fun. It's really boring, so much so that in the Rocky movies, every single one of them has a long musical montage in the middle, which is the training segment. And they try to make it as interesting as they possibly can, but reality, it's grueling and it's boring. That's why he's out there punching sides of cattle beef and doing one-handed push-ups with the clap and things like that, just to try to make it some way. That's why there's kids running around, make it seem like it's a good time. The reality, though, is that's what makes boxing so hard. It is a lot of work. When those fighters sign a contract to fight at, let's say, 150 pounds, around that time they're signing that, they probably weigh between 185 and 205. So in other words, over that period of time, they've got to cut that much weight and get themselves in that good of a shape and do all the training that is involved. I mean, you saw in there, they were kept slapping him in the stomach with, I don't know what the heck that was, just, you know, kept beating him in the stomach to, you know, get him used to taking the punch, taking the hit, and strengthen up his abs for what's coming. On top of that, you're watching film, trying to learn your opponent, and it's just hours and hours of endless film study, and then going out to practice against that film study, and then watching your own film study, and it just goes on and on and on and on. And the reason why it's hard to stay on top in the fight game is because once you've hit a million-dollar payday, it's really hard to get a guy who's already made $10 million or $100 million to go back through that grueling training process again, because it's just that difficult. And the fight game is very similar to the way transitions happen in our life. At the very beginning of them, there's a lot of stuff going on, a lot of information going on, a lot of news going on, so much so that your head's almost spinning. I mean, sometimes you get thrust into it even unexpectedly, and you walk into your boss's office, and there's a pink slip, an empty box, and a final paycheck. Sign these documents. This is your last day. Pack up. And that just sets off a whirlwind over the rest of that day or the next week, where you've got to make a call to your family. You've got to tell your friends. You've got to say goodbye to your coworkers. You're immediately trying to figure out and assess what kind of bill. I mean, there's bills to adjust. There's a lot of decisions you're making very rapidly, very quickly, and that all happens really fast. But then you hit this period called unemployment or job search, and it takes a lot longer than you thought it would, and it's very difficult, and it's very grueling, and it's no different than when you get a phone call and it's from the hospital and says you need to be here right away, and pretty soon you're arranging flights in from all over the country for family members, and people are coming over to the house, and old friends are coming back in, and that all, it's this big, you know flurry of activity for about a month, and then everybody leaves, and you're there dealing with what comes next, and it's a long, grueling process of mourning and grieving and picking up the pieces of whatever comes next. And the hard part about the middle is before it happens, before the transition happens, you kind of have a sense of who you are, what you're doing, and where you're going. And these transitions, whether they're planned or unplanned, they really challenge everything about who you are, what you're doing, and where you're going to be going. And on top of all that, you don't know the answers oftentimes to what you're going to be doing and where you're going to be doing it, or even who you're going to be. What are the things about me that have to change or transition to move to this next phase of my life? I remember the first time I found out, you know, when I was having a child, I was like, oh my gosh, what do I do? I mean, it's like, you know, who I am is going to be changed forever because of this. And so you have these questions that redefine your very identity. And the thing about your brain is your brain loves routine. Loves routine. You talked last year about a habit loop, how your brain does not like have to work very hard. And so what it does is it has a habit loop. Like, you woke up and got ready for church and drove here with just one habit loop after another. You didn't have to think about how you were going to get here. You just got in the car and it like self-drove here. You probably thought more about what was on the radio or what your conversation was than about how you were actually going to get here, because your brain just did it. When you're in transition, everything's new. I mean, it's like if you're going through the death of a loved one, most people don't have a habit for that. I don't have like, oh, yeah, when somebody dies, here's what I do. Unfortunately, we don't have just sort of an autopilot process to get us through that. And you woke up and you went to the same job and the same cubicle, the same people every single day, and now that's not true anymore. Now your brain has to figure out, what time should I even get up? Or this has happened to several people. They get up and they put on their outfit for work, and all of a sudden they find themselves on a Monday morning, why am I wearing a shirt and tie? I don't have anywhere to go. It's hard because your brain just doesn't know what to do. And so there's this big adjustment that you're having to work overtime just to get through every single moment of every single day because nothing is routine. And then on top of that, with what makes this middle so hard is the uncertainty. The uncertainty. Like, I don't know who I am or what I'm doing or where I'm going. And the worst of all is I don't know how long I won't know who I am, what I'm doing, or where I'm going. I mean, I know that this is a transition, but so much of this is out of my control. Like I've sent out resumes and I've made a lot of applications, but I'm just waiting for a call back. Well, when do you think they're going to call? I don't know. And you have this restlessness where that's where people use this phrase, hurry up and wait. Because like you want it to happen and you want it to go through, but the middle is just this long, almost unending feeling time. You're waiting for the test results to find out if it's malignant or benign. And you don't even know how to plan because there's a lot of different things you would do depending on what that test result's going to be. And it seems like as if the lab's just going to take their sweet time, as though it really doesn't matter, it's really not pertinent to your life and your future when they get around to finally doing it, because all your test results are is something standing between them and a 5 o'clock happy hour. But they really don't care about the fact that you're sitting at home anxiously wondering, is this my last year or do I have many years ahead of me? And so you're just waiting. Or maybe you're waiting on a court case to come up, and you have no idea what the judge is going to sentence. Guilty, innocent, probation, years, I don't know. It's just a matter of waiting right now. I really don't know how it's going to turn out. I don't know if I'm going to be single forever or if I'm ever going to find somebody. I try and I try and I try, but it just seems like as if I always come up empty. And, you know, I'm ready, willing, and able. I just, you know, it takes two to have a relationship, and I can't find the other one for the two. So I don't know. So one of the hardest parts about this middle is just this uncertainty. And these middle periods, these land in between where you were and where God is leading you, there's this middle section, this transitional sort of pause, if you will, in your life, or this time out, if you will. It's a time that it can be used for transformational growth by God. I mean, that's what the boxer is trying to do in this time. He's trying to transform his out of shape, undisciplined body into a fighting machine. And it takes a lot of work to get there. It takes a lot of work to transform your body into fighting shape like it needs to be. In the same way, it takes a long time to transform our lives into what God wants us to be. A change doesn't happen overnight. I remember back when I was in college, 18 years old, I felt God calling me to be a pastor. And my response was, you know, I had several. One was like, I think you got the wrong guy. Somebody then reminded me, if God's calling you to do it, you can't fight it. And I was like, okay, well, I can't fight it, but I'm looking at the calendar. I got 3 more years at being a part of the number one party school in the country, and then I'll go be preacher boy someday when I have to. But for now, it's time to live it up. And I had this mindset that I could just do what I wanted for the next 3 years and then just flip a switch and all of a sudden be right with God. And you can't just flip a switch. Transformation isn't just flipping a switch. It's like somebody who is, you know, sleeping around, they're just going to flip a switch and all of a sudden be faithful in marriage. It doesn't happen. It just doesn't happen. You don't go from, I'm going to use and use and use and use, oh, I need a job now where I can't use, I'll just flip a switch and be done with it overnight. No, it's a process. It's a process. Process is a very fancy word for it's going to take you a long time. It's going to take you a long time. There's going to be a lot of trial and error. There's going to be a lot of figuring this thing out. You don't just flip a switch to be transformed to become more like Christ. You don't just flip a switch to be transformed into the person you need to be for where God is leading you for the next stage of your life. And so this transformational time, some people, when they go through this middle period, they're transformed in this time. But there's a danger in this time because this transformational period, this time in between, this middle time, it's also where faith goes to die. And you've heard the story. Oh, I used to go to church, but then such and such happened, transition, and I couldn't do it anymore. Lost her job, could be an addiction, could be if somebody passed away, don't know what it is. But basically what they say, I used to, had a transition, my faith died. And that's the question. And in this period in between, in the scriptures, it's often referred to as the wilderness experience. Many people go through a wilderness experience, and the reason why they call it a wilderness experience is because typically people go out to the wilderness when they experience it. And this isn't just in the Old Testament. You see that Jesus and Paul both go through a wilderness experience before they transition into full-time public ministry. And this wilderness experience is a time of testing. It's a time of trial. It's a time of transformation. Famously, Jesus, of course, goes out into the wilderness, and he is tested, or he is tried, or he is tempted, whatever you like the word, by Satan to see, is this really? Are you really going to be able to do this? There's a testing, a trial period as the transformational process happens. It's difficult. It's training. In the Old Testament, of course, the wilderness experience, I mean, it's almost like it's become ubiquitous with this middle transitional period. It comes from the nation of Israel. They were slaves in Egypt, and God was trying to transform them into becoming the people of God who would be a light to the nation so that all people could come into a relationship with him. But you don't just walk out of slavery in an idol-filled environment and all of a sudden just flip the switch, walk over the Red Sea, and walk into the Promised Land and instantly become a people of God who are a beacon for all people to look to as an example. No, there's a transformation that has to go through to get from one place to the other, and so they go out into this long wilderness experience. And the thing about these wilderness experiences is, I know it's cliche, but they're either going to make you bitter or they're going to make you better. You're either going to become very resentful of the path God's laid out for you, have a very embittered heart, and it's going to erode your trust in the faithfulness of God, or it's going to be a time of testing and trial where you are transformed into becoming more like Christ in the process. And the thing about it is so much of the factors of the transition are out of your control. This is the hard part. So much is out of your control. Even if you decide, I'm going to quit my job, I'm going to start a new business. It's out of my control whether or not anybody uses my business. It's out of my control. It's out of my control if anybody ever looks at my resume. It's out of my control. So much of the transitional period is out of your control. The one thing you can control, though, is what you do in the process and how you react to what comes. What do we say in CR? We accept the things we can't change and we change the things we can. And I got to take responsibility for the fact that there are things I do get to decide. I get to decide how I act, how I react, and what direction I want to go, and how I view what lens I view this transitional period through. Now, in the midst of your transition, there's going to be two very strong temptations. The first is fast forward. See, this long middle, there's a piece of you that wants it to go by as quickly as the training scene in the Rocky movie goes by. Okay, that was kind of an extended clip, I know, but I wanted it to be that length. It was about, 2 minutes maybe? And in 2 minutes, he goes from just a bum, no-name fighter to fighting for the heavyweight title of the world. That's it. That's what happens in just 2 minutes. No, that was months and months and months of a grueling experience. I remember after Melissa passed away, I would ask this question of almost anybody I talked to, whether it was somebody who had also been through a mourning and grieving process, whether it was my counselor, other pastors. I would ask them this question. How long is the mourning period going to last? Because right now it's darkness and it's black and I cry every day. I'd like for this to be over with. I'm tired of this. I'm sick and tired of it. And so I would ask, and I remember one person said to me, it could last anywhere from 4 months to, and I don't even know what they said after that. I said, 4 months? Okay, I want to be on the 4 month plan. How do I do it? If we were going to do 10 counseling sessions over the next 2 months, can we just kind of do those over the next, like, maybe 1 month. We could do, you know, we just double up, triple up, maybe go Monday, Wednesday, Friday to counseling. Can we do that? And just kind of, you can get all the information in. Just tell me what books. I'm an avid listener, you know, book listener. And if it's an audio book, I will just tear through them. Trust me, I've got plenty of time on my hands. I can't sleep at night. So just tell me and I'll listen. I want to be on the express plan to get through the morning and get through the grief. It's not that, you know, I wanted to, you know, put this person in my past. It's just, if you've been through mourning, it's miserable. And I just want to hit fast forward. Now, other people, you know, you have, the other ways we sometimes, you know, try to hit fast forward on this period is, this is why you'll see somebody who they go through a really bad breakup, and then instantly they're in another relationship. And you know it's a disaster from the start. And it just complicates things. You know, or maybe somebody's having financial troubles, and so they instantly try to go out and make some quick money, make some fast money. Because they're just going to solve it. You know, I don't want to, you know, I don't want to have to grind my way back and slowly pay off these debts. No, I just want to make something happen. And what happens every time you try to fast forward through the required transformational long middle of a transition, you end up having to go back to the start, go through the same transition. However, now you get the express joy of having to deal with the baggage of what you tried to do when you fast forwarded it. Now you've got this other relationship and the consequences of that that you have to deal with. Now you have this other debt from this money scheme that you tried to do that now you've got to deal with that. And so on it goes. The other temptation is when you're in the middle of the transitional period is you'll look at how difficult it is in the transition and you'll say, you know, I think I want to try to undo what happened. Maybe I can go get my old job back. Didn't you quit it because it was such a horrible place to work? Yeah, but you know, I had benefits. The hours weren't that bad. Some of the people who were there, you will go through all these rationalizations as to why going back is now actually a really good idea given where we're at right now. And this was what famously the people at Israel always wanted to do. If you look at their wilderness experience throughout the Old Testament, all they say, you know, they have hardship come up and they go, oh, if only we could just go back to being slaves. It was so good back then. You know, they get out in the middle of the wilderness and they don't have anything to eat. And they go, oh, you know, back when we were slaves in Egypt, man, we had full pots of meat to eat. We had all kinds of fresh garden vegetables and we didn't have to pay for it. It was just all provided. Wasn't it like table scraps whenever they felt like giving you something? Yeah, but you know, it's so much better than being out here in the wilderness where there's nothing. And so you have this desire to somehow go back to the very misery or difficulty that thrust you out into this transition in the first place. And of course, if you go back, what's going to happen? The exact same problems are going to come back up. And what this does is now you're going to get back to the same transition. You'll just have lost a lot of time and a lot of ground and have some more emotional scars and maybe less money, et cetera, and so forth. And it just makes the process all the more difficult. And so the reality is you have to accept this is going to be hard and it's going to take a while. Rome wasn't built in a day. You're not going to be transformed into the likeness of Christ overnight. This is going to take a while. The things that led to this downfall or that weren't right are the things that you got to fix moving forward, or else you're going to find history will repeat itself. If you don't learn from your history, you will repeat your history. And that's exactly what happens over and over and over again with the people of Israel. Another issue, another temptation that happens, I'm just going to read Exodus 16 because there's these two things come out of it. The whole desert community grumbles against Moses and Aaron. The Israelites say to them, oh, if only we had, you know, things we had back in Egypt. Oh, we sat around pots of meat and everything we wanted, but you brought us out here in this desert to starve to death and die. This is where this journey ends. Nice going. So first they want to go back. The second, you know, so sometimes you want to fast forward. Sometimes you want to go back. Those are temptations. There's another thing that comes in, though. It's this voice inside your head you see come out in this passage. There's this whispering voice that says, you know how it's really bad right now? You know how hard this is? This is your life. This is it. This is your lot in life. It's never going to get any better. The circumstance is never going to change. You better get used to it, pal, because this is your life. You see, we're going to die in the desert. This is it. This is the rest of our life right here. This isn't some kind of transition from slavery into a promised land. There is no promised land. It's just this barren wasteland in the desert is our destiny. You've been there. And in the midst of that, God is telling you over and over and over again in the scripture, it's captured perfect by Ecclesiastes 3. He says, listen, life is seasonal. Life is seasonal. There's a season. I slapped the earth on its side, knocked it on its axis so you would have seasons. You'd be reminded just by the time of year that there is summer and winter summer and fall and winter and spring. Sorry, I live in Virginia Beach too much. We go summer, winter, fall, back to summer. Then we go straight to winter, back to fall for a little while. Winter, 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 summer day, winter, winter, spring, spring. Nope, nope, still back to winter, spring, spring, freaking hot, right? That's kind of the way it is around here, you know? So God's telling you, listen, life is seasonal. Now, I'm going to read from Ecclesiastes 3 when he talks about the seasonal nature of life. And as I read these, I want you to think, you're going to hear one of these, and I want you to remember back a time where you experienced one of these seasons, and you thought that season was going to be your life story, where you thought that season of life was going to be the sort of tombstone word of your life. He says, there's a time for everything and a season for every activity under the sun. There's a time to celebrate with new birth. And there's a time when you watch somebody die. There's a time when you get to plant and think about the harvest that is to come. And there's a time to uproot and do all the hard work. There's a time to kill and a time to heal. I always think about cancer and that, where you're trying to kill the cancer cells. And what a grueling process it is when you're trying to kill the cancer inside. And if you've been there, you know what this is like. And that's just, it's a season. Then there's a time where your body heals from that chemo and heals from the radiation. There's a time to tear down, and there's a time to build. There's a time to weep. As hard as it is to believe, there will be once again a time to laugh. There's a time to mourn, but there'll be a time when you're dancing. There's a time to scatter things, and there's a time to gather them back up. There's a time to embrace, and there's a time when it's not a good idea to embrace. There's a time to search, and there was a time when Natalie Holloway's parents had to give up searching. There's a time to keep, there's a time to throw away. There's a time to tear apart, and there's a time to mend. There's a time and a season we need to be silent. There's a time and a season when you need to speak. There is a time for love. And believe it or not, there's actually a time for hate. There's a time for war. And there's a time to make peace. You know, as you think back over your life, maybe you've been in that season of mourning and you thought, I don't know if I will ever laugh again. I don't know if I, you know, everything being torn down, I don't know if we'll ever have the money to rebuild. I don't know. It seems like as if everything around is death and destruction, and I don't know if there'll ever be anything to celebrate. We're just going to die out here in the desert. And God says, no, this is a season. It's a transitional season from where you were to where I'm leading you, and it's going to be hard. It's going to be difficult, but it's not going to last forever. And there's going to be a time when you do get to the forever. When we sit around in eternity, and I've placed a sense, this beacon of eternity, that you know that you are an eternal being. I've put a sense in you that this life really is about nothing more than a loving relationship with me that'll last for all eternity. And someday when we're sitting there in all eternity, we will look back over all of these seasons, and you will find beauty in them. He summarizes, he says, God makes all things beautiful in his time as you sit with him in eternity. You need to read Ecclesiastes 3 if you're thinking about the permanency of it. This time in the wilderness for the Israelites, though, was such a productive time. I mean, it's easy to overlook that with all the difficulties and all the hardships they had. It was such a productive time. I mean, think about the amazing faith statements that you find throughout the entire Old Testament that all go back to this bedrock time of what happens in the wilderness. They would go, he is the Lord our God, the one who brought us out through the Red Sea. He parted the waters. Anybody love that song we sing about, you know, you parted the waters before me? You know, you split the Red Sea. I love that. I mean, even today, we're still singing about the wilderness experience of when God parts the waters. It was out there in the wilderness where God gave them the Ten Commandments. This is how you should live. It shouldn't be by the whims of some dictator and his own personal preferences. No, no, no. This is the rule of law. Everybody needs to follow it. Nobody's above the law. You need to look to me, and you need to care about one another. Honor your mother and father. Don't exasperate your workers. Give them a day off. Don't be taking stuff that's not yours. Don't be killing people left and right. There needs to be protection for people. All that came in the wilderness. He allowed them to create the Ark of the Covenant, which was a symbol of the presence of God that would be there in their midst to reassure them, even as you walk through the wilderness, I am with you, I am with you, I am with you. I will inhabit the presence and the place of this Ark. And you can build this tabernacle where you can come and you can have a worship time where when you forget and your foot almost slips and you think that there maybe is no God and there is no way, I'm going to have a tabernacle for you to come and worship and celebrate. I'm going to have a system for you to deal with the sin that is committed. There'll be this scapegoat that we do, and we'll just let that scapegoat just run to the other side of the wilderness as if all your sins have left upon it, and I'm going to provide for you again and again and again, even so that when Jesus comes, they look back and they say, Moses gave us manna from heaven, what can you do? Remember back in the wilderness when God provided? So God does a lot of amazing things as he's trying to transform them from slaves to being his representatives on earth. Now the thing about the middle, though, that you learn from reading Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. By the way, that section is not for the faint of heart if you've ever read the Bible. Genesis, exciting, fun. People are like, I'm going to read through the Bible this year. Genesis, oh, this is great. This is wonderful. This is going really well. You will bog down a little bit after Exodus 20, okay? Exodus 20, it just gets rough. It's almost like as if God says, here's the deal. If you want to read through this, I'm going to give you the wilderness experience. Like, this thing will never end. This saga will never end. It's almost repetitive and goes on and on and on, just like their experience was repetitive and went on and on and on. If you've read it, you understand that joke. The one hallmark, or the one word I would use to describe this period, is complaining. Sometimes you use the word murmur, grumble, or whatever it might be. Murmur and grumble is just when people are complaining to one another, okay? It's complaining. And they're complaining continually. If you read Exodus chapter 15 and 16 and 17, I don't have time to read them. I'm going to summarize them for you. What happens in Exodus 15? They're crossing through the desert. They're running out of water. They've been without water for several days. And all of a sudden, they come up on this oasis right in the middle of the desert. Like, oh, praise God. Thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you. This is perfect. We finally found water. And they go up to drink it, and it's salt water. God, I've been praying for a man. A guy finally calls me back. He's got no job, he lives with his parents, and he's an addict. Are you kidding me right now? What, you a little salty? Yeah, just like the water they found. You've been there. And so what do? They complain. Why'd you lead us out here in the first place? Finally, when we get something good, this is what you do? Is this some kind of sick joke? Was this your plan all along, just to lead us out here? We should have just stayed there and died. Why die out here? We could have just died over there. God, you don't know what you're doing. I was like, all right, Moses, just throw a stick in the water. I'll take care of it. Stick, water, how does that do anything? Just do it. And also the water's drinkable. Next chapter. We ran out of all of our food supply, Moses. We left Egypt. We had a lot of food with us. We had a lot of, livestock with us. That's all gone. We've been eating it quicker than they can make babies to resupply it. It's all gone. We don't have any more crackers, don't have more fruit, no more vegetables. We're out. Did you have somewhere you were going to lead us where we could plant something? Did you have somewhere you were going to lead us where there's a herd of buffalo or something running across the wilderness? I don't know. What's out here? Probably no buffalo over there, but yeah. Anyways, moving on. Is there an ibex? what's going on here? What's going on? God? I don't think I can say the word suck in church, but I know I have said that sometimes about God. I get that frustrated with me. That's sort of a quick summary of what they say in that moment. God, you stink. You're an idiot. You don't know what you're doing. You don't have any plan here. You messed up. You miscalculated. It's off course. You've lost it. I mean, where are you going to get enough food to feed all these people, God? I mean, certainly this is beyond you at this point. And God's like, it's raining, man. It's raining. Sorry, that's a bad one. Some jokes are good, some aren't. Sometimes these things go through my mind. Anyways, just food just starts falling out of heaven. And like, what the heck is this? I don't know. What is it? That's just what they called it from that point on. They called it, what is it? That's what word manna means. And so they found 1,001 ways to Bubba Gump shrimp that manna over the years, right? Later on, they get sick of the manna, and they're like, okay, God, we're done with the manna. Can you give us anything else? Sure, I'll just make flocks and flocks of birds die overhead and just start dropping on your heads. You'll have so much meat to be coming out of your nostrils. What, you don't think I can do something like that? Watch me. Then Exodus 17, now they need water again. Okay, last time you turned salt water into fresh water. guess what? We don't even have salt water now. The stick trick was pretty cool, but now there's nothing but rock. There's nothing out here, God. Okay, so you could turn salt water into fresh water. You can make manna rain down from heaven, but what you gonna do now, God? There's no water out here. We're in the desert. Just strike the rock. It'll start gushing with water. It's gonna become a fountain instantly. And it happens again. Every single time throughout this process, and in your middle, in your wasteland, in your wilderness experience, in this land between, the question God's gonna continue to ask you is, do you trust me? And their answer was, no. No, we don't trust you, because you don't know what you're doing. You don't care. This was an ill-conceived plan. You've lost control. This is now far beyond you. You kind of thought you had it together, but I think you've, you know, written some checks your body can't cash. I just don't think that this is going to go anywhere. Sorry, I'm just using all different kinds of references this morning. You've kind of overextended here, God. Now, as they're grumbling and complaining, guess who else is complaining? Moses. See, I told you, if you're in middle, you're going to complain. Even the godly, even the spiritual complain. If you're not complaining, you're not in the middle. I don't know what you're in, but it's not the middle. It's not a land between. It's not a transition. You know, it's a bad day, okay? It's that was inconvenient. If you're not pushed to the point where you're complaining, it's not the middle. So here's one of Moses' response. He says in Exodus, or I'm gonna flip over to Numbers because I like the way he puts it in Numbers. Same thing, same stuff happens with water and manna and quail over in Numbers that happens over in Exodus. So Moses hears a cry of the people at the entrance of their tent, and the Lord becomes exceedingly angry, and Moses was troubled, and it says, all right, God, why have you brought all this trouble on me? What have I done to deserve it? Are you just so mad at me that you're gonna put all this stuff on me? Are these all my kids? Am I their daddy? No, I don't think I am. Why do you expect me to hold their hands and nurse them? I can't do none of that. They keep wailing, give us meat to eat, give us meat to eat, give us meat to eat. I don't got any food for them, man. If this is how you're going to treat me, kill me now. See, you're not the first person to pray that. That's an old prayer. A lot of people prayed that one. If this is what my life's going to be like, if this isn't a season, if this is just what my life is going to be like, I'm done. Just take me out, okay? I'm not going to walk away from you, but I don't have the energy to follow. I don't have the energy to take another step. I mean, I don't want to be disobedient. Can we just end this here now? And he comes back. He's like, but if by some miracle of a chance you actually do care about me and you actually do love me, then you got to do something here because I'm spent. I'm done. I don't got anything else to give. Read it, Numbers chapter 11. So they both complain. What's the difference between the man of God and the grumbling people? God's angry at one, and he responds to the other with great compassion. What is the difference? Because they're both complaining. Because complaining is just what you do in the middle. Okay, it's not like the godly go through, oh, this is just wonderful. God, I trust you. I trust you. I trust you. Like, I used to read the Psalms and be like, I want to slap this guy because he's like, oh, God, I just trust you. You know, when my whole life falls apart, I trust you. It's just wonderful. Like, who the heck is that? No. Reread the Psalms. David's complaining. If you're in the middle, you're going to complain. The difference is this. You're either going to complain about God or you're going to complain to God. And there's a huge difference. There's a difference between saying, God, you don't know what you're doing, and I'm done. I've had it. I want to leave. I want out because you don't know what you're doing. Either you don't love me, you don't care about me, or you can't do this because this is beyond your control. So I'm out. I used to go to church. Then this happened. Now I'm done. That's complaining about God. Moses, though, says, God, I don't understand this. Why? What are you doing? I'm at the end of my rope here. I'm pushed to extremes. If you want something to happen, you're going to have to do it because I got nothing left to give. And what you'll see in the scriptures is Moses has this kind of complaint, and Elijah has this kind of complaint, and Jeremiah has this kind of complaint, and Job has this kind of complaint. Over and over and over and over and over again, people complain to God. And God's big enough to handle your complaints to him. And he loves you and will answer you in the midst of them. And so the question is, when you go through the middle, is, are you complaining about God or are you complaining to God? So with that, let's close out in prayer. Father, you know, God, I've been complaining and complaining and complaining like nobody's business this past couple weeks. And Father, I just thank you for the example of Moses and Elijah and Job and Jeremiah. These amazing men of God that would be so frustrated in their moments that they would cry out to you and complain. And you would answer them and you would comfort them. You even baked Elijah a loaf of bread. So, Father, may we follow in their footsteps and in their path and in their example and complain to you when the road gets too hard. Complain to you when we lose sight of the seasonal nature of life. Complain to you when we have some question in our mind as to what you're able to do or what you're willing to do or what you will do. And trust that you're the God who hears, who loves, who's got too good of a track record to walk away from now. And in Jesus' name we pray. Amen.
Thank you for listening to the Essential Church Podcast. Let me encourage you to pause for a moment and reflect on what you've heard. It's not the hearing of the word, but the application that makes all the difference.